previously on Accused.
You know, then he started asking me a bunch of questions. I asked him, you know, where was I, this one. Automatically being, you know, living that lifestyle, I'm like, okay, now I'm a suspect in this crazy stuff.
It went the way it seemed like it should have went. Now, I wasn't on the jury, I wasn't a prosecutor, I wasn't there as a policeman at the time, but the old, and I hate the cliche, but if it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck, you know, it's probably a duck.
I'm Amber Hunt, and this is Accused, the unsolved murder of Aretha Welch. Every criminal case is a brand new jigsaw puzzle. In fact, it's something of a cliche in the courtroom. In one murder case I covered in Michigan, the prosecutor literally made huge puzzle pieces to assemble into one giant prop in his closing arguments. A phone call here, a hair discovered there. He flipped each piece over and, on the backside, portions of a portrait began to emerge. On their own, the clues mean nothing, but join them together, as this prosecutor did, and you sometimes end up with a convincing portrait of a killer. The shoe prints, hair samples, and jilted ex-girlfriend were pieces of the puzzle that landed William Virgil in prison for killing Aretha Welch in 1987, but they weren't the only ones. A big piece came by way of Aretha's boyfriend, James Becker, who said he spotted a man in Aretha's hallway the Thursday before her death, a man he identified in a photo lineup as William Virgil.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
James Becker met Aretha Welch long before her death, back in 1976. According to his testimony, by the time she died in 1987, they had dated on and off for nearly 12 years. Becker said he cared very much about Aretha. He helped her give up heavy drinking in 1980, and while she still had a drink now and then, he considered her a reformed alcoholic. Becker had been questioned by police, and what he told them matched what he would testify to later in court. I'll relay that here, but with a caveat. We've since learned that some of what he said might be bogus. We'll explain which part soon enough. First, his version of events. He said he and Aretha spent the Wednesday before her death fooling around. Aside from sex and showering, the couple spent much of the day messing around with VCRs. They bought the one for Aretha's apartment and eventually got it working, but then went and rented a different one to use at James's place. That one wasn't compatible. At some point, they had lunch at a place called Beef and Boards and eventually watched half of Top Gun at Aretha's apartment. The VCR back and forth is a mess. It's pretty nonsensical. From Becker's telling, they just bounced from one pad to another. Here's me reading one of Becker's initial statements to police.
And then after that, she said, let's go back over to your house. We went back over to my house, and then we got over there, and we were just getting bored there watching Channel 9. And she said, let's go back over and get the VCR.
This audio is from when my producer, Amanda Rossman, and I drove to Chicago to peruse the original notes in the case as collected by the Innocence Project's Elliot Slosar. We were allowed to read them and to take notes, but we weren't permitted to make actual photocopies. You know how lawyers get.
I guess that was a little after nine or after. We went over and got the VCR. I come out the door with it. She was coming out the door getting ready to close it when this guy was coming down the hallway. I said, hey, what's happening? He said, okay, you know, like that.
The guy was a bit tough to see because he was wearing a hooded sweatshirt with a hood pulled up. Plus, it sounds like there was a bit of machismo in the mix, with the two men not really acknowledging each other. They were both there for Reatha, after all. Becker said he went out to the car and waited for about 10 to 15 minutes before Reatha finally showed up and got into the passenger seat of her car, which Becker was driving. She said her hallway friend, Ricky, needed a place to crash that night, and she was going to let him stay. Becker didn't like that idea. He testified, quote, "I said, just tell him you're not working tonight. She said, I can't do this. The Lord wouldn't like it," end quote. According to Becker, Reatha said two things to help identify her gentleman caller. She called him Ricky, which was Virgil's nickname, and she said he'd just been released from the hospital. Reatha took some beer and some champagne she had bought earlier and tried to convince Becker to come back to her apartment with her. He said he refused. That's the last time he saw or spoke to her, he said. He tried to call the next day, on Friday, but couldn't reach her. He left two messages asking her to call him back so they could talk. He never heard back, so he said he called one of Reatha's daughters and asked her to go check on her mom. Becker said the next time he heard anything about Reatha was in the Cincinnati Post, which reported her death. He went straight to the Newport Police Department and talked to Detective Mark Brandt, who took a statement. Then Brandt showed Becker a photo lineup. He wasn't positive, but tentatively identified William Virgil. The next time he saw Virgil's face, it was on television after his arrest. And by then, Becker was positive he was the same guy from Reatha's hallway. Still, Becker acknowledged his view was obscured by the hood, and he said the lighting in the hallway was dingy, like what you'd find in a motel. He couldn't see the man's hair or ears. He saw his eyes and nose and the rest of his face, which was clean of facial hair. Virgil, meanwhile, had both a mustache and a beard at the time. Becker also acknowledged being angry that Reatha was opening her house to another man. Patton asked him, "Were you becoming irritated at this time?" Becker, "I became irritated when she came down and left him up there." Patton, "And how hot were you at this time?" Becker, "Warm, mister, warm. I could have killed her myself that night. I was mad." During the trial, no alibi was requested from or offered by James Becker for that Thursday night or any of the nights that followed. Back in Slosar's Chicago law office, we spent considerable time trying to find any notation of Becker's alibi in the various police reports. We kept an audio recorder rolling while we read through the records. One report we found detailed an interview between Mark Brandt and James Becker, who sometimes goes by Jim.
In this interview with Mark, Jim is not actually asked, like, straight up for an alibi. Here's what Mark says. "Was anybody at your apartment Thursday night?" Jim, "No." So he has no alibi that he's providing for Thursday night.
He's not asking if he went anywhere or if he did anything else.
But what he says is, I'm home alone. Because his child, his son, was dropped off to another kid's house, last name Lewis. Don't know his first name. They call him Boogie.
You don't know who your kid is with.
Yeah. So Boogie Lewis is where Jim's son is. And apparently, other than that, there's no alibi for Jim Becker.
Becker assured he had nothing to do with Reatha's death and was so devastated when he read about it that he threw the newspaper he learned it from. He told Brandt, quote, "I didn't kill her. I swear I didn't kill her. I loved her. You know, if anything, I loved her. I swear that. I'll take your polygraph test or whatever to prove to you I didn't kill her. I wouldn't hurt that woman for nothing in the world. She was good to me," end quote. Still, there's no alibi. This started to bug me as I read page after page of interviews with a guy. They asked what kind of wine glasses the two drank from, but they didn't ask where he was the night his girlfriend was killed. I asked Virgil about Becker.
What about Becker, the Reatha's like kind of boyfriend, who said Ricky was in the hallway? Do you have any idea where that came from?
No, I know we didn't like each other at all. So
was it like a dude competitive thing? Or
he wasn't any competition. He was just a date. You know, as far as she was concerned, I think they had one time been in some type of relationship, but they hadn't then, and he had been pursuing her, and so, you know, I didn't care whatever it was that she was doing. I didn't know him personally. You know, he knew about me, I knew about him, he didn't like me, and I didn't care. You know, so.
So he would have seen you prior, like if.
He probably saw a picture of me or something, but we.
Did you ever meet him in person? Oh, okay. That's what I was trying to get at. What do you think he did see in the hallway? Do you think that was...
I wouldn't have a clue.
We were having a tough time reaching James Becker. Virgil's lawyer aimed to depose him as part of the civil suit, but Slosar was having a hard time reaching Becker, too.
I went out to Arizona 2 weeks ago, maybe. It's a little bit of a burden to go talk to Becker. And I couldn't confirm whether he lived there or not. The neighbors just said that they were, like, unhelpful. But we had an address that was being used for him as recently as January.
This was in February. Slosar went out twice to Arizona, in fact, but no one answered either time. Turns out there was a reason. I found a death record stating that James H. Becker, born in January 1931, died in Arizona in 2015. He's buried in Fort Mitchell, Kentucky. All I really knew about James Becker was what he said during trial, that he had trouble holding down a job, but that he had worked for a while at the Wiedemann Brewery, which matched the brand of beer bottles found in Aretha's apartment and car after her death. I also knew that the VCR Aretha bought with him was never recovered by police. In the records Amanda and I perused, we saw that James said he and Aretha had dropped his teenage son off at a friend's house one of those days. So, in a sort of Hail Mary pass, I decided to try to reach James Becker's son, who was a teenager when Aretha died. It took a few months, but I found him. What he remembers is why I don't think that James Becker was entirely truthful on the stand.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
James Becker's son is Tony Becker, who was about 15 when Aretha died.
I've known Aretha when I was just a little kid, even younger, way younger than that. My dad known Aretha for years. They was the best of friends.
He remembers her as a member of his family and said his dad had talked of marriage.
You know, she was like a second mother to me. And yeah, everybody just loved her. You know, she was just so... you know, great-hearted, because she was really, you know, into the Lord and everything.
He was hit hard by her death, which he learned about from his father.
He says, son, sit down. And he goes, how much do you love Aretha? I said, sure, I love Aretha like she is my own mom, Dad. You know. And then next thing you know, he just started crying. And he handed me the paper, because that's how he found out in the newspaper. And that's how I found out. And he handed me the newspaper, and I just looked at it, and my whole body just got numb, just numb. Like, no way, not Aretha, you know?
But this isn't all Tony Becker knows about this case. His memory of his father's last encounter with Reatha was completely different than what James Becker described in court.
I left out the door first, and my dad was coming right behind me. And that guy, he was on the far left, off towards the against the wall, like from the door. And Reatha was like letting us out the door. And that's when we was walking, and I looked back, and that's where I seen the guy standing in front of Reatha's doorway talking to her. I remember it vividly. And he was dressed in a hoodie. He had a hoodie on, like a sweatsuit outfit, you know, like a Rocky outfit, but he had the hood on and okay. stuff. A big brother. And yeah, I didn't get a good description of his face or anything.
I asked Tony why he was never interviewed, why it appears police never knew there was another witness to this hooded figure in Reatha's hallway.
No, like I said, he didn't talk to me or get any details or anything with it after all that.
Okay.
He was overprotective of me. So he didn't want me to probably hear anything or be involved in nothing.
I also had to ask the obvious and uncomfortable question about whether he realized his dad's name was still being floated as a possible culprit in this crime. In recent court hearings, William Virgil's lawyers have asked why James Becker wasn't weighed more heavily. One lawyer, in requesting DNA testing, pointed to Becker's testimony that he had only had vaginal sex with Reatha because she didn't like it any other way. A point made because seminal fluid was found in Reatha's anal cavity as well.
On the Becker testimony that you have before you, Judge, that was done that talked about whether or not she enjoyed anal sex or didn't, and whether or not Mr. Becker had sex with her that morning, and the serologist was then asked...
The lawyer wanted to test that fluid to see if she could catch James Becker in a lie.
Oh, definitely not. Definitely not. That's ridiculous. Definitely yeah. not. I mean, I was right there. I was right there with them.
Yeah.
And I saw the guy. I don't know if it was that guy that they saying that he might be the wrong person with the DNA or so. But I saw a guy with a hoodie and a sweatsuit there.
Unfortunately, Tony can't describe the hooded figure well at all. He knows only that he was fit and black and maybe 6 feet or 6 foot one. By those scant descriptors, Virgil more or less fits, but he continues to say he never went to Kentucky after his hospital visit. If you consider Sue Daniels and James Becker's testimony body blows in the case against Virgil, what we're going to talk about next is the knockout punch. The KO comes courtesy of a lifelong criminal named Joe Womack. When I say lifelong, I mean as of now. Since he testified against William Virgil, he's spent a combined 13 years in state prison for burglary and robbery charges, according to the Ohio Department of Corrections. At the time he testified, he was 2 years into an aggravated burglary sentence out of Cuyahoga County. He's currently being held in the Lake Erie Correctional Institution on 4 charges, 2 counts of aggravated robbery, 1 count of theft, and 1 count of aggravated burglary. His next parole hearing is in 2019. In working with Virgil's lawyers to tell this story, the only concession we made regarding reporting involved Joe Womack, and I'll be transparent about that here. Elliot Slosar asked us to hold off on attempting to interview Womack ourselves until after he gave his deposition in the civil case. We agreed. Slosar said the testimony was too important to risk Womack getting scared off by aggressive questioning by a reporter. I obliged, in part because I see no harm in waiting, but more so because I see Slosar's point. What's alleged to have happened here with Joe Womack in this case is, in short, explosive. Womack was being held in Lebanon at the same time William Virgil was there. Lebanon's in Ohio, about a 40-minute drive northeast from Newport. Remember, Virgil wasn't charged straight away with Reatha's murder. Rather, he was picked up for violating parole, and that parole stemmed from Ohio, so he was plopped in an Ohio prison where Womack was in the midst of that burglary sentence. Here's what Womack told jurors in the 1988 trial. He said the previous August, so about 4 months after Reatha's murder, he got a visitor at the jail, a visitor who smuggled in some marijuana. Womack was being held in an isolation cell, which is where you're sent if you misbehave. Virgil was also in isolation. In fact, Womack said, the two were sharing an isolation cell, and soon they started sharing the marijuana too. So they're sitting there in their isolation cell, smoking a joint, and they start talking. Quote, first we was just cool and we were rapping, and he told me he had a parole coming up, and he had a detaining from Kentucky for a murder. As the conversation progressed, he had told me that he had just come back from New York, and he went to see his PO, and his PO PV'd him, and that's how he got to be in the institution in Ohio. PO, of course, is short for parole officer, and PV is parole violation, which in prison lingo is changed to a verb. Womack said Virgil's PO asked him if he knew anything about a girl being murdered, and Virgil relayed that he told his PO no, he didn't know anything about it. But that wasn't true, he told Womack. In fact, he had gone to see a woman named Rachel or Retha and tried to get some money from her. They talked for a while, then went to the store in her car and then came back to her apartment again. Womack, quote, then he said they got into an argument. He bust her in the head. He panicked and he stabbed her, end quote. Prosecutor Ebert, did he tell you approximately how many times he stabbed this woman? Womack, he said he stabbed her a whole bunch of times. Ebert, what did he say that he did with the body? Womack, he said he drug her into the bathroom and put it in the bathtub. He continued that Virgil cleaned his prints and bailed. He drove Retha's car from Newport to Covington because he was going to sell it, but decided against that and just left the car. Virgil went to his father's house, but no one was home, and that wouldn't work for an alibi, so he headed on to a woman's house. Womack. And then he tried to get the alibi together to say that he was there with them the whole time. Womack said they never spoke of the murder again. He told an officer in the jail about the conversation straight away. If the story's true, Virgil's an idiot. Who confesses murder to a man he's just met in solitary confinement? By Womack's testimony, they had been in the cell about 16 hours before Virgil spilled his guts. This is a guy who hadn't even copped to visiting Kentucky because he knew that would get him in trouble for parole violation. But for some reason, he copped to a cellmate straight away about a murder in a state with a death penalty, no less. Virgil was not pleased with this testimony, not because it was damaging, but because he said it wasn't true.
Did you meet Womack in this setting? The
first time I saw him was when he came in the courtroom.
You, as far as you know, you never crossed paths with him?
No, I've never seen him.
Yeah.
Virgil remembers being in solitary confinement. He remembers what landed him there, too.
I'll tell you what happened. I was in a hole because they had asked me to shine some doorknobs, brass doorknobs, and I just wasn't that type of...
So you said no?
Yeah, I don't do that.
Politely, you said no?
Yeah, I just, you know, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do it. You know, I knew where I was going, but you couldn't get more than 15 days for anything. You know what I mean? But I still wasn't getting ready to do that. But, so when I was in a hole, I was fighting extradition. When I got out of the hole, Niecy Karen Oglesby called me.
Oglesby is a friend at Virgil's who would eventually testify at trial.
Which was who I was with at that time. And told me that they had something on the news about I had confessed this crime to someone. And I said, confess what? What are you talking about? How can I confess anything to someone I don't know anything about? And she said, well, you better find out who it is. And, you know, with my mindset then, okay, who's in here trying to get out of the penitentiary by telling this lie? And so I didn't know a name. You know, and they didn't repeat, they didn't even say a name on, and I didn't even hear it on the news that they had got a confession until I got to, when I got over here in Kentucky, that's when I found out the gist of it.
Wow, okay.
Except for what she told me.
This he said would play out in dramatic fashion before the jury.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances,
places. Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
There's a saying that a lawyer who represents himself has a fool for a client. Maybe so, but William Virgil at least had the sense not to go solo. As coarse as he might sound, the man has a good grasp of the law. As his prison sentence unfolded, he was one of those inmates who learned everything he could, reading legal textbooks and helping his fellow inmates file appeals and motions. But before that, he insisted on being his own co-counsel in his murder case. He just wanted some control in his proceedings. His life was on the line, after all, and he trusted no one to fight for his freedom as hard as he would himself. The only time during the trial that this really mattered was during Womack's testimony. Virgil insisted on cross-examining the man he was supposed to have confessed to. Virgil, you stated that we celled together in isolation? Womack, yes, sir. Virgil, so if we'll check with the institution, they'll verify that guys celled together and that you and I celled together in isolation in the month of August. Womack, yes, sir. Virgil came back to this again and again. We celled together. In the same cell? On what floor? Together, you're saying. He asked it in so many different ways that Womack lost patience. How many times are you going to allow him to ask me the same question? 8 times to that question, he told the judge. The judge agreed. It is getting repetitive. But there's a reason Virgil wouldn't let it go. He knew that inmates weren't allowed to cell together in isolation.
And I just felt like something just told me that to just stick to that particular, because that's, I felt like that part of it would, you know, if it was exposed that we weren't in the cell together, which I knew the records would reflect, then it would prove that this man lied. And I couldn't get the information no other kind of way, so that's why I asked that question so many times. And then when he said something about, yeah, they'll verify it or something like that, you know, that's not, I felt like Perry Mason, you know, okay, no further questions. I thought that was kind of cute, so.
He's right. The cells were single, period. No one can double up. Bob Patton, Virgil's original defense lawyer, didn't want his client handling the cross-examination, but he didn't have a choice. It's the kind of thing that you have to tolerate if your client is also his own co-counsel. Patton today says Virgil did the case more harm than good, though when he describes his own cross-exam with Womack, it doesn't sound like he did much good either. He decided to get in Womack's face in hopes of getting the witness to punch him from the stand.
I realized that if I did it right, I think I'd probably get him to take a swing at me or something, because he really, really was cocky, and I called him that and told him several things that probably were not, he took umbrage at. So I turned my back to the jury, and the judge couldn't see me that well either, and I invaded his space. You know, if you take that extra step forward, people kind of react like that. Instead of doing that, he just started, you know, gnashing his teeth and looking at me. I said, I think I guess guy take a swing at me. So I said, you made all this up, didn't you? And I leaned forward like, you made all this up, didn't you? And he didn't take a swing to me, but.
In a more conventional moment, Patton at another point asked Womack what he was getting from prosecutors for testifying. Womack replied it was a hell of a question. He said, quote, I've got a mother, sister out there, and if you let that guy out there, man, if this jury of his peers let him walk, you know what I'm saying? I'm putting a little more values and scruples in my life. I'm getting a little bit more morals. End quote. Patton pressed. You're being promised nothing. No early release, no parole, no nothing, right? Womack, not a McDonald's hamburger. Patton didn't request proof from the prison that Womack and Virgil had indeed shared a cell together, but he did try to paint Womack as a liar. He brought to the stand another jailhouse informant named Andrew Becker, no relation to James Becker, who testified that he had overheard Womack bragging that he was framing Virgil. Andrew's been in and out of jail over the years. I tracked him down through his sister's cell phone recently, and his story hasn't changed. Warning, there's some offensive language ahead.
No, I was in jail when two guys weren't there talking about it. And they said, fuck that nigger downstairs. I remember as funny as day with how it went. And I told them what they said, and they said I was lying, and I turned back. I heard that was the guy that did it. But I don't know that, you know?
So when you testified, you were talking about a guy who hadn't talked to you. You, like, overheard him talking to somebody else?
Right. Two guys upstairs. No, I was standing there when they was talking, you know? I mean, it wasn't like they was hiding it from me or whatever, you know? They just, and then I got downstairs, throwed in the hole with that. Well, Berger was beside me, and I got to talking to him. I told him about what the fuck was saying upstairs. And he said, well, hey, will you help me out in court? I said, well, sure.
The recording's a little muddy, but the gist is he says he heard Womack and another man talking about framing Virgil. He thought Virgil was an okay enough guy that he let him know. And when Virgil asked if he would be willing to tell a judge what he heard, Andrew said sure.
Why get involved? I mean, you could have just...
Right, I said, I kind of liked old Virgil. He was pretty, he wasn't bothering nobody. I mean, I don't know why. I didn't care. I was going to join anyway. I didn't care. You know, I mean, I know what I heard.
Jurors had to choose which jailhouse informant to believe. That they sided with Joe Womack maybe isn't surprising. Womack sounded pretty convincing on the stand.
It's, you know, that cross-examination and all the years that I've worked on these types of cases is pretty incredible, because Joe Womack went absolutely out of his way to prejudice the jury into wrongfully convicting William. You know,
that's Elliot Slosar, Virgil's lawyer today.
You know, by spontaneously, you know, saying that he was volunteering to testify to save, you know, his, you know, sisters and all the women in the Northern Kentucky area from having to live with somebody like Mr. Virgil being free on the streets. And it was shocking to me as an attorney that there wasn't a mistrial, because it was obviously so prejudicial. But, you know, William actually, one of the fascinating things about this case is that some of the best evidence relating to Joe Womack that was developed, you know, and that we were going to use at the retrial, was that William actually filed a lawsuit against the state of Ohio. And through that lawsuit, he issued his own written discovery, including requests to admit, in which he got the state of Ohio to answer them, which is a feat all in of itself. And the state of Ohio, you know, agreed in these requests to admit that William Virgil had never been in a cell with Joe Womack, because the cells were single cells at the prison that they were at. And so it was really incredible work by somebody who had no legal experience, you know, was without representation. And those types of answers, I think, corroborated the evidence that we eventually developed relating to Joe Womack.
We'll talk about the evidence in a minute, but first, more about this lawsuit. Because this is a big deal. It's an impressive move for an inmate to pull off anything quite like this. Here's me talking about it with Virgil and Slosar.
I remember when I was in that jail, and I told you that they had locked me up in the segregation cell, and I filed in 1983. I was watching Louisville play DePaul down there, and I was just laying in the bed one Saturday watching that game. And it just, the idea of taking that road to try to get that information, it you know, once you start getting those law books, man, this just stuff just comes to you. You know, you read all kind of angles. So I filed a lawsuit against Lebanon Correctional and the warden for the same thing I filed against the jail, for denying me my constitutional rights to general population, or the things that general population were entitled to, which would be considered church and all of this. And then I was entitled to have someone in the cell with me, you know. And so by doing that, I knew it wasn't it's impossible for them to put two people in the same cell in the hole. It's for punishment, it's not for you to enjoy, you know what I mean? So when I filed it, and then I found where they had a thing called interrogatories and admissions, where you can ask a direct question. and I asked that the answer be a yes or no, instead of allowing them to go into depth and explaining it, which would give them room to kind of wiggle out of what I was doing. You know what I mean? So I just asked them directly, did I have a cellmate? Are you entitled to a cellmate in L-block isolation? Was I allowed to go to church? Was just a smokescreen for the other. And so when they responded, no, you're not allowed to have a cellmate. No inmates are not entitled to cellmates in a maximum security area. And I read that. It was like, you know, that was about the biggest thing ever happened.
I can't underplay how remarkable this was. Virgil filed a lawsuit alleging his constitutional rights were violated by the Ohio Department of Corrections. One of the allegations that he wrote to them, in the positive, as in he wrote it as though it were true, was that he had a right to have a cellmate while in the segregated part of the Lebanon prison. As part of the discovery process, the plaintiffs replied to Virgil's allegations. Instead of agreeing with the cellmate statement, they denied it. No, you're not allowed a cellmate. There are no cellmates in isolation. And that's how Virgil backed the state into proving Joe Womack lied on the stand.
Considering the fact that, you know, he wasn't an attorney, it was a pretty creative way to go about getting this type of evidence. If William had sent a letter to the Ohio Department of Corrections saying, I'm wrongfully convicted, this person falsely alleged that I confessed to him, will you help me and get me the cell rosters? They would have said no, and they would not have helped. And so this was an avenue that he was able to use.
So this lawsuit that you filed basically backed them into confirming that you were alone, which contradicted what Womack testified to, which was that he was in a solitary cell with you.
Yeah, it makes it impossible for any of that to happen.
So Womack lied about the shared cell. It wouldn't be the first time a jailhouse informant provided false information on the stand. Here's Colin Miller, the professor at University of South Carolina's law school.
The issue we have with informants is when you're in prison, and for the reasons we just discussed before, your likelihood of being released are very low, your primary incentive is to, in essence, snitch on someone. And there's a lot of motivation there to claim that someone confessed to a crime, and that's led to numerous cases across the country where eventually it turns out that that jailhouse informant was lying and making up the charge.
My background in crime reporting has made me more familiar with a different kind of so-called snitch. In some big cities, my former Detroit home included, lots of solvable crimes go unsolved because, as they say, snitches end up in ditches. So when I hear snitch, my brain gravitates toward a neighbor with information who's intimidated into keeping quiet. Snitch has a bad connotation on the streets. But to me, snitches can be heroes, people stepping forward to do the right thing despite the danger. So-called jailhouse snitches are usually different. They're often all too eager to spill what they know, and maybe then some. To learn more, I reached out to Alexandra Natapoff. She teaches law at the University of California's Irvine School of Law, and she's author of the book Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice. Before joining academia, she had worked in the criminal justice system as a federal public defender and a community legal advocate. She wrote her first piece on informants in 2003 and has been immersed in the topic ever since.
It was shocking to me. Really to learn just how important and secretive the use of informants was, both inside the criminal system, but also in people's perception in the neighborhoods of Baltimore of just how central informant use was to law enforcement. People talked all the time about the snitches in their neighborhood, about drug dealers who were snitching. It was common knowledge in the community that the use of informants was a big part of how law enforcement did its job, even though it was not publicly well recognized.
In 2006, Natapoff wrote a paper published in the Golden Gate University Law Review called Beyond Unreliable, How Snitches Contribute to Wrongful Convictions. She's since turned the bulk of that paper into one of the chapters of her snitching book. The statistics involved are jarring. About 15% of overturned convictions were cases that featured jailhouse informant testimony. Zero in on wrongful convictions in capital cases, and the percentage goes up past 45. In other words, in nearly half of the overturned cases where the defendant had landed on death row, a jailhouse informant had helped put him there.
So there are a lot of challenges with using criminal informants when you think about it. They're basically paid criminal offenders who the government is cutting a deal with in order to get information, which is obviously inherently a very risky proposition. One of the most famous risks of using informants, of course, is that they're going to lie, that they're going to give false information in exchange for their own liberty, which many courts have recognized is just about the most tempting deal you can offer someone facing years in prison. Jailhouse informants are a particularly infamous subset of informants. Of course, there are all kinds of informants. There are white-collar informants. There are drug informants. There are college students who are pressured to become informants. But jailhouse informants have commanded quite a bit of attention recently, in part because we have been able to learn just how often the use of jailhouse informants leads to wrongful conviction, often in very serious cases, capital cases, homicide cases, very, very serious cases in which we get the wrong answer because the government relies on and then the jury believes a paid criminal jailhouse informant. One of the classic scenarios of a jailhouse informant is when the informant comes forward and claims that someone in the jail confessed to them, the sort of my cellmate told me scenario. And this is a scenario that comes up over and over again. It's so routinely leads to wrongful conviction because it's a he said, she said scenario. You have two people in a cell. It's very hard for the government and for the jury to know who's telling the truth and who isn't. And so numerous states have actually passed legislation to restrict and regulate this particular phenomenon.
So Virgil was right. And what he was claiming actually shouldn't have been so shocking to everyone involved. Joe Womack lied on the stand about sharing a cell. But it turned out Virgil was wrong about that being enough to overturn his case. Prosecutors instead said, fine, so they weren't in the same cell. Maybe they were in adjoining cells. Wherever they were doesn't matter. Virgil still confessed the murder to Womack. He knew way too many details about the murder. It's just one convict's word against another. Or is it? Next time on Accused.
The phrasing that he heard, you know, they found he perjured himself at trial, or he was a perjurious witness, gives the impression that, you know, nothing he said was true.
Do not believe somebody who is in jail who said your client, my client, confessed to them.
This is a special project by the Cincinnati Enquirer and Cincinnati.com, reported and narrated by Amber Hunt, edited by Amy Wilson, produced by Amanda Rossman and Phil Didion. Music was composed by Andrew Higley. Kimberly Armstrong assisted with research. For photos, documents, and more, go to accusedpodcast.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.